on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
We're not just material flesh and blood and nuts and bolts, that there's something else. And I think it's a different level, a different dimension. It's sort of like the physical body is the condensation of some of these higher realms of emotions and thoughts and energy, and ultimately consciousness. So I think it starts at consciousness, and energy is sort of the in-between level that has the most direct impact on the physical body. So if you learn these techniques to manipulate your energy, you can affect your physical health greatly. And a lot of it has to do with adjusting your state of consciousness.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, author Eric Leskowitz, MD, joins me to discuss his book, The Mystery of Life Energy, Biofield Healing, Phantom Limbs, Group Energetics, and Gaia Consciousness. Eric discusses what's wrong with the modern medical worldview, the power of group energies, the Global Consciousness Project, the similarity between ley lines and acupuncture meridians, and energy hygiene. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Eric Leskowitz, MD, is a retired Harvard Medical School-affiliated psychiatrist who practiced pain management for more than 25 years at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston. He has published more than 50 articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals and is the author, editor of 4 books, including his most recent publication, The Mystery of Life Energy. His documentary about group energies and sports, The Joy of Socks, aired nationally on PBS in 2012. Rick, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to speaking with you about a number of things in your book, which I enjoyed. It was very thought-provoking, and it hits a lot of ideas that have been featured on the podcast before, just in different ways. So I'm looking forward to this. Early on in the book, you noted that, and this is a direct quote, modern science and medicine have taken off in a mistaken and even dangerous direction. And I was wondering if you could discuss that.
You go for the most provocative sentence in the whole book, do you?
Yeah.
I do think that the worldview, the model that lies behind Western medicine is wrong. Mm. It's incomplete and it's wrong. And because we're so wedded to it, it becomes dangerous. And it really cuts off so many options that we could be pursuing that we haven't. And, you know, there's many examples of it. Part of it is how we've become, I think the basic issue is that we tend to view the human being as a machine, that we are our bodies, and our bodies are complicated machines. But if we can figure out where every part goes and take it apart and put it together again and break it up into smaller parts, we'll be able to fix everything. And that's it. There's no real understanding of what holds it all together, what coordinates it, what orchestrates it, what makes it a coherent whole. And that's because Western medicine is the only healing tradition in the world that does not include some sort of invisible force or vitality or life energy, as I've called it. You know, people are more aware of it these days. In yoga tradition, it's called prana. In acupuncture, it's chi. So, you know, it's becoming part of the cultural awareness, but medicine hasn't embraced it yet. When you do embrace it, it gives a better understanding of the underlying causes of diseases, and you're not just tinkering with symptoms and trying to suppress them, because that really, that's what so much of modern medicine is suppressing symptoms. Hmm. We fight against the symptoms as though the symptoms are our enemy. And, you know, one way of putting it is, just look at the types of medicines we have. We have antidepressants and anti-anxiety and antibiotic. It's against. There's not pro anything unless you count Prozac.
Yeah.
That would be my worst pun of the day. So
So
that's where it gets dangerous, because by suppressing things, you don't really get to the underlying cause, and you don't focus on things like lifestyle factors or stress factors that could be so healing.
Right. Yeah, we need a more holistic view of things.
Yeah.
And this worldview, the idea of the body as machine, the human as machine, is wedded to a materialistic worldview as well. And the idea of energy doesn't really work in that. And my understanding is that some hospitals, maybe even the majority of them now, and I could be definitely wrong on that, allow for like acupuncture. And I know a lot of insurance will cover acupuncture, but from this model that modern science and medicine is coming from, they can't explain acupuncture, can they?
Yeah, no, I think that it's a good point. A lot has changed. I went to medical school in the late 70s, so that's like 45 years ago. And things like acupuncture were just ridiculous. I
Yeah.
actually had a professor who said that the reason acupuncture works in China is because all the citizens there have been told by Chairman Mao that it will work. And so it's sort of a mass hypnosis kind of thing. Not at all being open to possibilities. But a lot has changed. I think acupuncture was the sort of the thin end of the wedge as far as getting energy into Western medicine. And I think what first happened was people started to recognize that it did work, that it was effective. Then they tried to discount it by saying, well, we don't understand how it could possibly be. There's no such thing as invisible healing energies. So that was a way to discount it, but people kept getting better. So that enabled people in the healthcare system to start taking these risks. So now you're right. There are a lot of hospitals that have acupuncturists on the staff. More and more insurance companies are beginning to cover it. It was something like that would have been unheard of back when I was in my training. So it's wonderful to see. There's another example is one of the hands-on energy approaches, biofield approaches called Reiki. There, it's now fairly common that volunteers from the community will offer their services free of charge in hospitals and will go into the hospitals in the evening and they'll treat patients, they'll treat staff for free. And, it's hard to turn down something free like that, but the feedback is always very positive. And so then they start doing some research, what conditions can this help and how could it possibly work? And that's one of the areas that I've been interested in is how could it possibly work? Because some of the things that people report are quite unusual. And, I think mainstream science will accept that the body has electrical activity, nerve impulses flowing, and that generates magnetic field. So there, we don't end at the skin. There are ways of measuring with pretty reliable devices that the magnetic field extends out beyond the skin. But then what gets really interesting is when people do these different sort of mind-body practices, how that affects the magnetic field. And that was one of the areas that I got interested in because of that sports documentary that you mentioned for viewers who may not be aware of it. The baseball team in the Boston area is called the Boston Red Sox, and they had a very long, like I think it was 86-year drought between championships. And it's actually 20 years ago now. It seems like only yesterday, but they won the World Series, and it was such a amazing sort of group phenomenon that all of New England was really caught up in this. It was like the best antidepressant ever. So there were these group energies in the community, but also watching the team play, you could see that there was a special kind of chemistry that they had. So I got interested and I was sort of, writing. I wrote what do you call it, an op-ed in the newspaper that it was fun because it pointed out how the team was having trouble the next year and how they could get their act together by using some of these subtle energy approaches for chemistry and bonding and stuff. And I thought that was kind of the end of it, but my cousin's a filmmaker. He actually approached the Red Sox cold and said, "Did you read that op-ed yesterday? We're doing a documentary about it. We'd like to come to Fenway Park and start filming." He didn't even ask my permission. But so we got the okay and we started filming this documentary that part of it was interviewing players and what their sense is of group energies and especially energy from the fans and how that can, energize them. But we also spoke to the scientists who are studying this field. And, it needs to be more out there more. So this is a kind of a palatable way of presenting it. But we did some recordings too. One of the experiments we did, I was actually a guinea pig to see whether my heart rhythms could be affected by people who were near me doing this heart-centered meditation. And what was interesting about it was I was blindfolded and I had, actually, where are they? I had, this sort of, so I couldn't hear what was going on in the room. This was done in the laboratory at the Institute of Heart Math in California, who's been doing research on what they call heart coherence for several decades now. And they found that when you're in a certain emotional state, particularly appreciation, your heart rhythm gets slips into it. It's not a metronome. The heart's not a metronome, but it's not all revved up like when you're anxious. It goes through these ebbs and flows that are very even and predictable, what they call heart coherence. So in this test, I sat, relaxed in my baseline. I did not know how to do the meditation technique. So that according to the readout, I was not in a state of heart coherence. And the director, talking about it afterwards, looking at the graph, the director, Roland McCready, said, "Rick, you're in a very incoherent state here," which I didn't take as a personal insult, though it sounded like one. But what happened was that the people came in behind me at a time I wasn't aware of. He gave them a signal, and they know how to get into this state very, very quickly. Within, I forget, it was like 5 or 10 seconds, it was that soon, my heart rhythm shifted. I was entrained into the same rhythm that theirs was in, even though I wasn't consciously doing anything or didn't actually know how to do it. So something shifted just by their being present. They were, probably 3 or 4 feet behind me. Excuse me. So something in the space between us resonated. It was a lot like tuning forks that, I'm sure everybody's played around with tuning forks, that you can make one, sets up a certain sound frequency and another one will start to vibrate to it. That I was like a tuning fork resonating to them. And just as an aside, that 5 minute segment of that demonstration can be viewed on YouTube, and you look up the Joy of Socks movie, and then you can see either the whole 60 minutes or this particular research segment, because it's very cool. I guess I would have to say it's very cool that, we didn't know whether it was going to work or not, but it really did, and it was such a dramatic example. So what we were saying was that in team sports, if the team members have that sense of appreciation for each other, their hearts will be resonating with each other. When you're in that state, your reflexes are sharper, your nervous system is sharper, you perform better. So we were talking in terms of this being part of the athletic experience of being in the zone where everything just sort of flows effortlessly. But there are some of these physiologic markers, and we think that was one of them, and it's a contagious one. So the team, individuals can practice it among themselves, within themselves. Teams can practice it among themselves, and even fans can influence the team by the fan energy state. So it was only sports, but it was a very significant demonstration, I think.
So it leads to a lot of other questions. And one of the first questions, I think, is it seems is because you also discuss the Global Consciousness Project. And that's something I wanted to talk to you about. But it seems as if there is this connection somehow between this energy and our consciousness. And because the materialistic worldview, they can't ex describe or explain consciousness either.
I mean that's a really important point, and neuroscientists will admit it. We may know every single synapse or nerve connection. We may know which neurotransmitter is going where, but we still don't understand how that leads to the sensation of being aware of consciousness. And it's this sort of kick the can down the road and say, well, we're almost there, and if we get this DNA thing, or that's the promise. And that's what attracted me to medicine in the first place and to psychiatry. I thought I could understand the mind because minds are pretty cool, and I enjoyed mine. I enjoyed having one, and so it was interesting to try and figure it out that way. But it just didn't lead anywhere. It's very interesting. It's amazing to see how complex the brain is, but it didn't help to understand consciousness. And that's why I think you have to step out of the materialistic model, to use the term that you use. It's we're not just material flesh and blood and nuts and bolts, that there's something else. And I think it's a different level, a different dimension. It's sort of like the physical body is the condensation of some of these higher realms of emotions and thoughts and energy and ultimately consciousness. So I think it starts at consciousness, and energy is sort of the in-between level that has the most direct impact on the physical body. So if you learn these techniques to manipulate your energy, you can affect your physical health greatly. And a lot of it has to do with adjusting your state of consciousness. And that can be, meditation. It can be sports. Actually, one of the coolest quotes I've come across over the years was by Michael Murphy. He was the co-founder of the Esalen Institute, which started in the 60s on the California coast. It was like the mecca of the human potential movement. And so a lot of these, techniques were being explored, but Michael had an interest in sports. So he was particularly interested in the sports applications of it. And he wrote a lot about what has been called and is now called the zone, that when you're in the zone of peak performance as an athlete, you're in an altered state of consciousness that's a lot like what the spiritual masters try to attain, because your ego is not a part of it. You're just flowing. And so he said, sport is the yoga of the West. And I love it because it validates, sports, and it puts it, they're just different paths to the same goal. So I think that's a really important way to, tie levels together.
And when you were talking, that's the first thing that came to mind was yoga, in the sense of that this is a condensation of sorts of consciousness and energy, because that's what's in the yoga philosophy, is what we are. We're a condensation of all this stuff. But I do want to talk a little bit about this global consciousness project, because there's it seems like it's expansive, going from, I think that you can have like the energies of a family, and then the energies of an event, like a sports, event or a concert or something, and then maybe even, like with a city. But then there's a global kind of consciousness, and this has been measured. And the question I have is, I was hoping that you can maybe explain this, because this is something that I've always struggled with a little bit, is in that measurement with the random number generators.
I think I may disappoint you because I can't really explain how it happened, but what you're referring to for viewers and listeners, this is a device for measuring human attention. The upshot is, if people pay attention to a computer in a certain way, they can alter its behavior. It goes back to research that was done at Princeton University, which is I have a Harvard affiliation, but I'll grant that Princeton's pretty legitimate too. The Department of Engineering. It started as a student project, but the professor was so intrigued that he kept at it. So they've come up with a bunch of different systems where people pay attention to devices in a certain way and alter their behavior. The one that's a common exhibit in a lot of science museums is the ball cascade, where there's a funnel at the top, a lot of marble-shaped balls fall down and they hit pegs and they either go to the right or left, and it ends up being a normal distribution of after you do a couple hundred of the ball. So there's actually some it looks kind of crazy actually, but a guy sitting in a chair facing this machine meditating because he is using the power of his mind to push them more this way or that way. And believe it or not, small changes happen every time in the direction that's intended. So over time, it adds up to statistical significance. It's not like he can make this ball go from here to there, but there's this general trend. So that's kind of a gross physical example. What they did that was really brilliant was same as like flipping a coin, heads or tails, it's this way or that way. The computer can be programmed to generate a stream of ones and zeros randomly, thousands of times per second. So you can get a huge effect. And normally, there'll be a little bit of variation from a few more to the ones, a few more to the zeros, but within this narrow margin of likelihood. And anytime the output goes above to a statistical significant degree, you know something is happening. So they did this the same thing in the lab where people would meditate and could reliably impact that. So, you know, they said, well, this is very interesting in the lab. What about out in the real world? And they started taking it to different places, to different events, and finding that when there's a very strongly focused human attention, the output becomes less random and more coherent again. So the original lab was called the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Study, PEAR. So it's called the PEAR lab, and that was the foundation. But one of the offshoots was Roger Nelson, one of the staff people, got interested in this global question and set up these computer units around the world. I think there was many as 60 or 70 of them, and basically had them running all the time, regardless of what was happening in that lab or in that city or in the world, and to see what kind of output changes would happen with world events. And they're just, it's very weird, but there are some major correlations that they've noticed over the years where when it's not just thousands, but when millions of people are focused on the same thing at the same time, these computers everywhere will begin to show changes. And you know, the website, the Global Consciousness Project, will have some of the graphs. I have a couple of good ones in the book because, oh, it's just like one of them in the highlights section of the website, there's about a dozen photos, and one of them is the one day's recording from this global network during what is called Global Sound Healing Day. A sound healer from Boulder, Colorado, named Jonathan Goldman and his wife Andy have coordinated this for a number of years, where they have people anywhere around the world on a particular day, Valentine's Day, as it would happen, focus on making sounds in a healing way. And it could be singing your favorite prayer song or just humming, chanting, but making a vocal something or other. And what they found was that during that day, the graphs from the Global Consciousness Project were off the charts. So it's not that a computer in, you know, Boulder could hear my voice in Boston. It's just something at another level altogether. And that's what you're alluding to, this sense that there's a global web or network of consciousness that's not physical, it's not tangible, but it does interconnect us. And I think that's such an important understanding to have, that we're all in this together. I mean, we're all interconnected. It's certainly not the theme of everyday life now. You know, I just read the newspapers and it's all us versus them for all sorts of reasons. We find plenty of reasons for being in opposition to other people, but we forget the fact that at bottom, at base, we're all unified. And so the Global Consciousness Project, I think, is one of the really key sources of insight that, no, it's a scientific experiment, but it has a spiritual significance, spiritual meaning that hopefully we can wake up to in time, because it's getting pretty fraught our times. You know, there's some tension in the air. So these kind of approaches can make a big difference. So I'm really, really appreciate the work that they've done.
Yeah, it seems like it gives us hope in the sense that if we can get our, like you said, get our acts together, that we can act with almost like a unified will of sorts, but it doesn't seem like it would be that difficult. And what really interested me about this is, and I'm going to use the language of feeling, and this is connected to energy, because one of their graphs, and you include this in the book, was 9/11. And when 9/11 happened, people, I think, across the nation, they could feel something. And the closest I could describe it to was, I had lived in Denver when Columbine happened. And when Col and I knew people who were involved. I have a friend who graduated from Columbine. But when 9/11, there was this like cloud over Denver when that happened. And when 9/11 happened, it was like, this is exactly what that felt like, that there was this feeling involved, and it definitely affected the energy. And it's interesting that, if you can feel that, then we can work with it in a way, but we have to acknowledge its existence, right?
Yeah, I think our society is not good at honoring emotions and feelings. And, in a way, it all goes back to big boys don't cry, that, men learn to cramp it down. And there's all sorts of side effects of that, including bullying of the big one. But I have to say, the educational system has really changed a lot. And I mean, many school systems now, emotional intelligence is part of the curriculum, and kids are learning how to respect other people's feelings and how to respect their own feelings. So I think this kind of sensitivity is growing. But you're right, when a often a tragic event like 9/11 or Columbine happens, it does send shockwaves. I mean, that's a shockwaves is a physical figure of speech, but I think it literally is. Thing goes through the air, whether it's etheric or, I don't know what level of physical reality is, but something definitely happens that way. The machine, the computers can now measure it, but human beings can feel it. And it makes you wonder what goes on in places where it's not just one event for one day, but it's ongoing. So war zones, for example, I don't even want to try and imagine what that would be like to live there, to have that be like your mode of being every day is always of survival and fear and adrenaline and all of that. So it's very hard to get any sense of heart coherence or human interconnection and kindness in those kind of settings. In Boston, we had analogous, but it was just the anniversary a couple of days ago, the Boston Marathon, the bombing event then. That also did the same thing. It set up kind of shock waves. And it took the city a long time to sort of recover from that. And ironically, or not, I don't know if it's ironic, but interestingly, one of the healing steps that Boston as a whole went through was through the Red Sox, that they had a ceremony in honor of it. And the star player, David Ortiz, made a brief but very impassioned speech about how we have to reclaim our city from the fear. He used a couple of four-letter words, and because he was just felt so passionate about it. And that changed the vibe of the city. And again, I don't, that's an interesting question to go back and the moment that he said that, what did that do to the global consciousness recordings? Because that was a very palpable emotional transformation that he helped to bring about. So yeah, these kind of events are really important. And it's not only tragic events, obviously. That was, I'm trying to think of a famous one, but well, for example, just this last week or 2 weeks ago now, the eclipse, the solar eclipse, lots and lots of people went to see it if they were anywhere near the pathway. And we're in Massachusetts, so my wife and I drove up to Vermont to get into the zone of totality. And it was pretty crowded. Those roads were pretty crowded. So A, the event itself is awesome. Totality is really an unusual sensation. And that might do something to energy fields in and of itself. But also the fact that you had so many people focused on the same thing, what effect did that have on global consciousness? And those guys are working on analyzing the data. So they'll be preparing some sort of, output analysis to see whether an event like that brings so many together can also bring about that sense of global coherence.
Yeah, and that's what I was wanting to get to, and why I brought this up is because something that you noted in the book, and there's been some research on this in terms of having a positive effect or change on events, I guess, or attitude, just general attitudes. At one point, you talk about the Maharishi effect, and that if you have just enough people, and it doesn't have to be that large of a percentage, that are, I guess, get themselves into coherence, that in theory they could affect positive change.
Yeah, this was part of the model, the worldview from transcendental meditation from TM, and the Maharishi was the teacher from India who brought the practice over by way of the Beatles, which is why it got so popular so fast. But and that was actually my introduction to all these altered states of consciousness. But they posited that a certain percent, if a certain percentage of people were in this meditative state, the ripples would be so strong that it would affect other people's behavior. So one of the studies they did was, it's got to be at least 20 years ago, I'm trying to remember when, but in Washington, D.C., they had a big annual conference and they called as many people to come to Washington as possible to meditate, to be meditating during the day, during the course of a week-long intensive. And at the same time that was happening, the city's police department was doing what they always do, which is keep track of crime rates and violent crimes. And there's a graph in the book that shows from the published report that they printed that as the number of meditators participating in this workshop increased, the crime rate in Washington, D.C. decreased. And it went down by like 25% or something. So it wasn't just a little bit of a blip, it was like a major impact. And then when the workshop, the retreat ended and everybody went home, the crime rate went back to normal. So that's, I mean, that's so different from the new normal way of explaining human behavior, but it's so provocative. You wonder why not run some more tests and have a few more cities do this? Because the in the TM model, I think it was a tenth of a percent of people, or the square root of, it's the square root of 1% of the people is the critical mass, which isn't, it isn't very much. And I, the actual number doesn't matter. It's the idea that you can build up a field like that. And yeah, I think that that's what human beings are capable of. That's what our potential is when we're all focused on something positive. But you know, the flip side is when we're all focused on something negative, those things tend to happen more. And you know, the media, I hate to say it, but they're really interested in creating anxiety, creating fear, you know, selling more copies of the magazine or newspaper, and it, more people watching the TV news. So it's good for their corporate bottom line, but it's not so good for humanity as a whole. So it's part of our dilemma now.
It became profit driven, you know, and that happened kind of in my lifetime. But it used to be that news never made a profit. So you want to get people scared and watching all the time.
No, I mean, it used to be more of a public service to keep people informed, and now it's much more manipulative than it ever was. And it, you know, pushes a certain point of view, and you have to learn which outlets more conform to your point of view and which you can trust over the course of time. Have they been accurate about this or that, and what are their biases? And you know, everybody has biases. It's not
Oh,
like
sure.
there's some pure source somewhere, but you have to learn to take those into account and think critically.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, right now we're talking about human energies and human consciousness. And yet you also make the point that the earth, especially if we look at the earth as alive, that it also has an energy to it. And one of my areas of interest is always in climate change. And you wrote in the book, we can repair our damaged ecosystems by revitalizing Earth's energy grid, and that we can resist, you know, illnesses doing this. And I am really interested in this idea of the Earth having that there's an energy to the Earth. And there's a historical precedence for that with ley lines. And also, I have to talk to you about this. I see over your shoulder the calendar with the crop circle.
Good pickup. Very good. Very
Oh,
good.
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And one of the things that you wrote that really got me thinking about this is some of the sacred sites. You were connecting these ley lines with the meridians for acupuncture.
Yeah, that was this whole area of earth energies was the biggest stretch for me. You know, I knew that indigenous tribal people think of the earth as a living being, and I thought, well, that's very, I mean, I used to be very condescending, so that's very sweet, but it's so innocent and naive. You know, we know it's just made up of rocks and air and things like that. And you know, Western science now with ecology, we know how interdependent everything is, and so there's that sense in which the earth is a unified organism. But I do think now that there's also this energy and consciousness aspect to it as well. And there are some really good images on my website. If people go to www.themysteryoflifeenergy.com and go to the highlights, that's a series of about a dozen pictures. And some of them are crop circles like this right here that I'm pointing to, but others are about the acupuncture meridians that you mentioned. So let me just say a little bit about that because
Yeah,
it's
please.
such an interesting phenomenon. It started about, I should have looked up the date. I think it's about 150 years ago. A surveyor in England, he used to walk the countryside anyway, and he began to notice that some of these holy wells and smaller stone circles and sacred sites seemed to be in a line, that he was on one hilltop and he could see the other one right lined up. And so he began to map it out and found that it was more than just coincidence. And he called it the old straight track, or ley lines, as you mentioned. LEY is an old English term for that. And so he mapped out ley lines, but that's all he said. It was only more recently, in the last 50 or 60 years, that people began to put in the energy component to it, partly by dowsing, which is one method of detecting subtle energies, and finding that there is, in fact, a straight line all across the south of England, which is, I think, 200 miles worth, and things like Avebury Stone Circle, the Glastonbury Tor. I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's a really cool diagram in that site that I mentioned, where it looks exactly like an acupuncture meridian with points for the acupuncture points. And in fact, that's the notion, that each of those points was a focus of earth energy. And the notion is that the pagan people, the pre-Christian people who lived there, could sense it somehow or other, and they chose to make this the place where they did their ceremony, where they held their sacred observances, because not only was the earth's energy already there, but they could add to it by their group intention and raise up their consciousness to a higher level. And, we don't know the exact nature of their practice, whether it was to be in communion with the divine, or whether it was to spread fertility energy for farming in the area. We don't know that specifically, but we do know that it was a common practice. And really, kind of interesting, the Catholic Church, when it took over in England, they intentionally made some of their churches on the sites of these old stone circles. They would dismantle the stone circle, take the stones, and use it to build their chapel, as a way to kind of block it, to disconnect it, to short circuit the earth's energy. So nowadays, there's more of a move to re-energize those sites. And I'm not usually that woo-woo or far out to do this, but I did go to a workshop in New Hampshire, which is, I don't know where the viewers are, but, well, it doesn't matter where they are. It's still north of Massachusetts. But there was a site that was called America's Stonehenge, which is totally a marketing term. But there were stone formations or outcroppings that had gotten totally overgrown and wasn't clear what it was. But they were obviously had been put together a long time ago. And I went with an astrologer named Barbara Handclown, a group of about a dozen people, with the intention of reawakening that site. And, she led us in some chanting and toning and ceremonial stuff. And I actually got to the point where I could sense something. Some of the rocks, you would stand next to it and you could sort of feel like you're going up in an elevator. And she said that these spots, excuse me, were portals to higher dimensions. And that was the way I experienced it, was going up in an elevator. And that we had reawakened this particular spot. There's no hardcore way of demonstrating that, proving that to a skeptic, but that was a very unusual subjective experience for me. So I put a lot of credence in that. And people are doing this to other places around the world now. There's even a view that control of these sacred sites is an important part of some of the undercurrent of the political struggles going on, and that there are some important sites in the Middle East that whoever controls this vortex of energy can, it's more important than oil, actually is sort of the model. So I'm not quite sure how far I go with that, but I wouldn't be shocked if that's if there's some sort of like what do you want to call it, esoteric component to political intrigue that some subgroup is aware of this and is making that their focus too. So, but it's energy, and so it can be misused or it can be used for healing. And I think the potential for healing is just growing and growing and growing. And I think the so to come back to your point about the crop circles at these sites, especially in England, there seems to be a especially high concentration of these sites in the area where of Avebury. It's not as well known as Stonehenge. It's only like 20 miles away, but the stones are spread out on a greater area. But in the fields around there, about 30 years ago, people began to notice overnight patterns would start to show up, formed by the wheat stalks just being laid down rather than growing up. And well, there's not I it would be too disruptive to bring my computer over to the picture, but you can get a sense of they're very complicated geometrically. They're like 100 yards across, so they're not just little things. And initially, as it started to get more publicity in England, a couple of retired farmers said that they did it by dragging a plank of wood and knocking over the wheat in these patterns. But it takes like 2 minutes to look at that to realize that there's no way that could be. A, because the design's got to be so complicated, it would take weeks to map it out. And there's logarithmic spirals and fractals, and it's just amazing, amazing stuff. But also, the wheat stalks are not broken and smashed and crushed. They're bent, and the wheat grows in segments and with nodes. And at the first node, it bends like this, and it's rigid there. It's not broken. It's just rigid there and grows horizontally. So we have no way of replicating that. We don't know how to make that happen, how it could be, and I don't have a good explanation of it. But I do not think it's of human origin. And I've never seen a UFO or anything like that, but this is the closest for me that tells me that there's something beyond human intelligence in the world. And so there's something unique about that part of England. One of the sources that I quote says that because there are so many ley lines and sacred sites, the energy is smooth and coherent and clean. And these other beings can use it almost like a canvas to imprint some of these patterns, like the crop circles, as a sort of a marker, a higher vibration, a higher frequency energy for humanity to just kind of interact with. And it's not for us to decode them and figure out what they mean. It's more to be in awe of them and just have appreciation for the sense of wonder and mystery that we've lost track of. So we tried to, my wife is British, so we have had an opportunity to go to England a lot, and actually we're heading out in another month or two, hoping to see a crop circle. You obviously don't know when and where. We've had a couple of opportunities over the years to walk in them and around them and be in them. And there is something different going on. It's very hard to put your finger on, and they've done all sorts of measurements of magnetic fields and radioactivity and negative ions in the air. And there are a lot of correspondences, but it's nothing obviously clear explanation. But that's one of the things I would really love to see better understood and people more aware of. And not, I think that the first wave of publicity was all this negative stuff about these hoaxers. And that's what sort of stayed in people's mind. And it sort of makes it harder for them to revisit the phenomenon, especially in America. We don't hear much about it in America. In England, it's obviously more in awareness. But so I'm grateful for any chance to bring those images to a wider audience.
Well, the way that I've thought about these is I know that a lot of folks like to think that it's, extraterrestrials that are doing this, but I wondered, it's like, well, maybe it's just Gaia herself. Maybe it's just the energies of the earth that's doing it.
Definitely a possibility. The first explanation, the circles used to be very simple and were literally just circles or rings. And one of the theories was it was some sort of wind vortex that was almost a natural phenomenon. But as they've gotten more complicated, that's no longer possible. But you're right, that's definitely one of the strong possibilities, is that Gaia has her own consciousness and ability to, manipulate the energies on the surface. And, I think that's why the whole, another way of thinking about the climate change is that the organism of the earth, the physical body of the earth, is going through a sort of healing crisis now. It's analogous to in homeopathy, where they actually try and elicit the symptom so that it can be released. Excuse me. And all the, the kinds of weather abnormalities and earthquakes and volcanoes and stuff, that I think there's, at some level, that's part of the earth herself releasing some of these negative energies. And, I don't know whether it's physically from pollution in the air, or all the drilling that is, it's a intrusion, invasion, violation of her integrity. We, humans do a lot of damage to the earth, and if the earth is in fact alive, then it's got to register at some level. So this might be part of a healing process that obviously it makes it difficult for us, but I've also heard that it can be targeted. The areas are chosen so as not to be damaged. It's not like New York City is going to be the site of the earthquake, but there'll be the release of the pent-up energy can happen in some place that's not quite so dangerous for humankind. So we'll see.
Well, New Jersey got rattled a week or so ago.
Yeah, actually, we picked up that too. Yeah, were you close enough to the, did books fall off the shelf and stuff like that?
No, I'm in Denver, so
Oh, you're in Denver. Oh, okay.
I just moved back to Denver last summer from Southern California.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were in New Jersey. Yeah, no.
Nope,
Yeah.
nope, nope.
Yeah. So you've had wildfires and that sort of thing as your presentation is in
Lots
balance.
of fun. Well, I've experienced an earthquake here or there, but they're odd things, and there's always a energetic component to them.
No, I
Being
think
released.
what people out here are not used to earthquakes at all. So we had, it was a very mild one, but it was in a very literal sense an unsettling experience. Not only the ground shake, but your just sense of what's solid and what's real was shaken up too. So
Well, one of the questions that I have, and this is going just a little bit beyond the book, but not by much, and I think it's still pertinent, is with this change of pair. One of the things is, I know that Thomas Kuhn, who kind of wrote about this in the Structures of Scientific Revolutions, he says that what creates the necessity of a change of paradigms is an anomaly. And I've maintained for a long time that the anomaly with the materialistic paradigm is consciousness. And we can say energy as well. But there does seem to be this concerted effort in many ways to hang tight to the paradigm. And I see this, there's a element of indoctrination. I see this. One of the classes, I am a college professor, and one of the classes I teach is logic and critical thinking. And in one of the things I'm supposed to teach is pseudoscience, how to spot it and whatnot. And in one of the logic books I use, and it's probably the logic book that is like one of the top three in the nation, it talks about, like, it mentions psychic phenomena, for example. And it just flat out says, there's no evidence. And I struggle with that because I know that there is evidence. But at the same time, and you've mentioned this, a couple times in the conversation, this concern about being too woo, because it seems like once we open the door to some things, there are all these other things that can start rushing in.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. All bets are off. And I think that's why people hold on so tightly to the old paradigm, because you get identified with it, you get invested in it. And it's very threatening to think that somebody could just pull the rug out from under you with the Black Swan event, as James called it. So yeah, actually, I didn't know that you were a logic professor, but the whole thing about pseudoscience, you can make that accusation, but then test it out. follow the accepted rules for experimentation, and you'll see that there's really solid science behind a lot of this parapsychology, for example. And yet it's just so easy to dismiss it. I'm involved in one of the therapeutic techniques that we used in our pain management program was where patients would tap on their own acupuncture points and do some remembering and releasing. And so it looks kind of odd going like this. It's called energy psychology. And we were concerned because the Wikipedia article about energy psychology, it was all this talk about pseudoscience that you mentioned and quackery and, very dismissive and ignoring a lot of very solid studies. So we did this change.org petition and got like 10,000 signatures. And somehow or other, it came to the attention of Jimmy Wales, who's the guy who's the head of Wikipedia. And he wrote a very kind of nasty response. I mean, this is a professional organization with over 1,000 members who are PhDs and MDs and whatnot. And he wrote back defending Wikipedia's stance and saying, we will not be influenced by the sayings of lunatic charlatans. So he actually called us, he called me a lunatic charlatan. And, he's like the gatekeeper for information. And, you talk about indoctrination, that's really what it is, that certain stuff gets screened out and training only allows certain stuff to come in. So teaching people critical thinking skills is, I think, is really top of the list. And that's a really important thing that you're doing to bring that to the next generation, because otherwise it is very easy to get swayed when you're getting a certain kind of message everywhere, and then the ones who disagree are so easily dismissed. That as a lunatic charlatan or quack or what have you. And it's happened throughout the history of medicine or science. Another good quote is from Max Planck, who was one of the quantum physicists who kind of moved beyond the views of Newton around 100 years ago. And he said that paradigm shifts occur one funeral at a time. And it's very poignant, but it's true that the old guard has to die out and the new ones come in and take over the positions of power. It's a very tough process because people hang on to the old ways very, very tightly. And I think that's part of what's going on now too, I think, in the world at large, is there's such strong reactions and polarization because I think people have a sense that some big, big shifts are happening, and some people are want to embrace it, and other people are very threatened by it. And it for many people, it is a matter of life and death that you have to stick to the old ways. And so some, religious beliefs that were popular 100, 200, 300 years ago are still have a strong hold on people. And some of the political how the way that translates politically is we're seeing a lot of regression, but I think I see that as sort of the last gasp, sort of holding on of the old ways before the new era. I mean, it's like the dawning of the age of Aquarius. When I that was the from the musical Hair, the Broadway musical Hair, it which actually the music has held up really, really well if you like pop rock music. But this is one song about the coming of the new era, and it's a notion from astrology that we're ending the Piscean age and entering the Aquarian age, where things like cooperation and collaboration will happen, and that we're on the cusp of that now. And I'm not an astrologer, I don't pretend to understand it, but it is a common theme that there actually was a important transition point just a month or so ago where, ooh, I better get this right. My son's an astrologer, so I better get this right, that Pluto entered
Aquarius.
Aquarius. Thank you. Thank you. And that was a significant shift that, we won't see the full effects of it for a while yet, but it's sort of the tipping point. You could put it that way. It's like a tipping point, and there won't be any going back. So yeah, I think that's the underlying process that's going on.
Yeah, I'm always curious about the because we want to maintain like rigor and scientific method and whatnot, but we don't want to just operate off of indoctrination, you know. And I have no idea what that's going to look like. But
Do you make that like one of your topics is how to think about pseudoscience and evaluate claims of pseudoscience?
yeah, I have to teach that. This is going to probably be my last semester teaching critical thinking. But yeah, it's tricky because I can't in good conscience just, tell students it's like, well, this is, reject this, reject this, reject this. But, I'm probably the outlier. I imagine that a lot of my colleagues, because philosophy is also, weirdly enough, very much embedded in a materialistic paradigm. So I don't know how many of my colleagues might question these things or even know that, yes, there is evidence and that there is this censorship going on Wikipedia.
You'd get in a lot of hot water if you started talking about the validity of ESP or something like that.
I don't know how aware they are of my podcast,
All
so.
right, mum's a word, I won't tell.
Oh, that's okay. I actually resigned from one of the schools this week.
Oh,
So, I find it fascinating, and I think that we have to have these conversations. And I've grown. I've gone through my process of accepting certain things and being more open to various possibilities. And it seems like that's part of what we all have to do, is to be more open with everything. So I know that we're starting to run out of time here. It's unfortunate. There's a lot of things that we could also talk about. But let me ask you, what do you have coming up? What are you working on next?
Well, let me just finish up that last train of
Okay.
thought.
Yeah,
There's
sure,
a group
please.
that's come together and put out a white paper called Manifesto for a Post-Materialist Science. And these are some really great thinkers, philosophers, physicists, whatever. And they've written a short summary and then some more extensive documentation about how different worldview is necessary and outlining some of the evidence for things like parapsychology. So it's getting out there. It's just not as widely disseminated, but just for some of your viewers who might be interested in that. As far as me, next month I'll be going to the annual conference of the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology, ACEP, ACEP. That's also their website. It's also a good source of information on research for the clinical efficacy of these tapping type therapies. And there's been over 100 controlled studies now and double blind and meta-analysis and stuff, and it's really hard. I mean, the national what the American Psychological Association still hasn't given it, top ratings, but it's being used by the VA, for example, now. So it's getting there. So I do that as an annual meeting. I'm not presenting this year, but it's nice to meet with people who are on the same wavelength and get a very powerful group resonance effect just by being the conference together, and you don't have to be defensive about anything because everybody believes all this stuff. So that's a nice feeling, and that's something I'm looking forward to. I'll be going to England and hopefully seeing some crop circles. But in terms of research, there's one project that it's been very hard to have it come together in a way, and it's a little bit of a I can take a couple of minute digression on what it's about. It has to do with the pain disorder that happens after people suffer an amputation. It's called phantom limb pain. And it's very common for people to lose a limb and feel as though it's still there, as though the arm is still there. Not quite as common, but unfortunately often enough that they'll feel a very excruciating pain that seems to come from the missing arm or leg or whatever. And it doesn't respond well to medications and the usual stuff. So in our program, we had a few, not that many, people with that syndrome. And one particular guy was not responding well to the usual, it was a lot of mind-body approaches like meditation and biofeedback and stress management training and stretching and all. It didn't do well. So I said, would you be up for trying an energy therapy? And he didn't know anything about it. He didn't want to know anything about it because he just wanted to feel better. So in this particular approach, he laid down on the table and I assessed his biofield. So actually this is video so people can see it. If you do this sort of movement, at some point you begin with your eyes closed, you'll begin to feel some sensation between your hands. For some people, it's like a pressure or a tingling. And that, I believe, is the boundaries of your energy field here and here are bumping into each other. So you're actually feeling the edge of the energy field. So this particular treatment called therapeutic touch, I or the practitioner smooths out the energy field around the patient and balances out the energy. So I was doing it with him. I started at the top and was working my way down. He was missing a leg or part of a leg. So I, for some reason, I just kept doing that, smoothing out over his missing leg. And two things happened. One was that same pressure feeling that I was getting over his upper body, I could feel that same feeling over his missing leg. And at that same moment, he opened his eyes and says, "What are you doing, doc?" Because he could feel me touching his missing leg. So the phantom was not, neuroscience would say the phantom is created by the phrase is maladaptive neuroplasticity, which means the brain is just making it up.
Right.
But what my experience and many others have reported too is there's something out there. It actually exists in space. It's the biofield, it's the energy field, and you can actually sense it. So smoothing it out releases the energy and helps to dissipate the pain. But there isn't really a good way yet documenting it. And the goal is to find here to some way of taking an image of a phantom limb. Now, what we do know is that something similar happens in a leaf. That I may remember Kirlian photography is a form of taking the image of generally flat things because they have to the you have to be between the two electrical plates to take the image. But there used to be a lot of actually it's, sorry about that you could take the image of a leaf and show a corona around the edges of it. And so some experimenters 40 or 50 years ago, what happens if you snip off the tip of a leaf? And this is what they found, that you have the same corona discharge around the leaf, but it continues even where the tip is gone. And that shouldn't be. The image, the sense is that it's sort of a glow coming out from the leaf. But this image makes it sound like it's almost like a template. It's like the lines of force magnetic field that are there. When you sprinkle the iron filings on that piece of paper, you can see it. But if you sweep away some of the iron filings, it's still there. So I think it's an exact analogy for phantom pain that the cells in our body are like the iron filings. If you sweep them away by amputating them, the lines of force are still there and they can transmit sensations. So this kind of image turns out to be very difficult to replicate. And I'm working with a group of, electrical engineers and biofield researchers to try and fine-tune, because these original images were obtained like 40 years ago. And there's a lot of unusual factors that, like, for example, even the person who did the imaging had a certain kind of, we think, rapport with plants that help the biofield magnify. So we're working on developing that. That I think would be, if you start with replicating the phantom leaf, and if you can get a picture of phantom limb, like somebody, the image I have is if somebody's missing a few fingers like this,
Right.
say, you wouldn't ex you'd expect any kind of curling. I
Yeah.
can't get the line up. You'd expect something to follow the contour of the missing. But if you had fingers sticking up in space where the biofield still is, that just shows you that something completely different is happening. So we've been trying fundraising and just spare time working in the garage, but I would really love to see that come together in some sort of consistent research pattern, but it hasn't happened yet. And maybe that would be the next stage of things. We'll see.
Thank you for that, because that's one of the things that we didn't talk about was the phantom pain. And I found that section on the book quite fascinating. And if you don't mind, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Because I've got it written down here that, and this goes back to what we were talking about in terms of energy, that the coherence of energies. And it seems like with the healing process, there that's also at play when you're working with the energies of someone, like with the fellow you just described, who had lost the leg. And that at one point, you also noted, though, that it's possible to take on other people's energies that are not in alignment with yours. And this is the question that I had written down. Well, how can you protect yourself from that?
Yeah, that's a really important issue because we spend a lot of time with people who we don't see eye to eye with and whose vibe we don't like. But I'm sure we've all had that feeling of you come away from a conversation and you have a headache and they feel better kind of thing. They vented on you. And I think there really is this kind of energetic interchange going on. Some people can pull your energy. Actually a term for it, energy vampires. And one of my recent blog posts on that website, which you can go to and just click on the blog post, was about the extent to which, I guess I can name names, a certain well-known politician, I was going to say that President Trump draws energy from other people as his way of fueling his activities. And some people love it and they want to participate and other people don't. So how to protect yourself? The first step is really just to be aware that that is a process, that does happen. And to have some intention to keep your own integrity. There are many different images, and it's a process called energy hygiene. It's a very evocative term that you want to be clean energetically, the same way that you are physically. So it could be anything from, a golden globe or cylinder around you protecting you. Some people feel that the second chakra, the energy center, but just below the navel is where emotional resonance happens. So you can sort of imagine that instead of being wide open, it closes up to 10% or whatever. So you still can know what their emotions are, but you don't get swamped with it and overwhelmed by it. So there are ways of doing that. And there's actually books out there now about if you what to do if you're too sensitive. That's another way of talking about energetics that we do need to be energetically sensitive, and it's especially helpful in, like, for example, in psychiatry and in psychotherapy. You want to be able to tune into other people and know where they're at, but you don't want to, be absorbing it all. So it's how to find that balance, and it takes practice. And the beginning and end of each interaction, if you take a second to just acknowledge that you've had this and to release it, it sounds magical, but it is magical in a sense. But to release what you may have taken on that does not serve you, you can do that. And even in our interaction, it's been very enjoyable. But at some point, your energy is yours and my energy is mine, and we'll go our separate ways, and we'll be inspired by what happened. But you don't have to know about the problems I'm having with my vegetable garden and all. So.
Well, thank you for that. What I would always do is just like smudge myself with sage or Palo Santo or something like that.
Exactly.
But yeah, but I could feel it. There was the school I resigned from, as soon as I got near the campus, there was like this darkness that had accumulated over it. And that happened over the past 15 years or so.
Oh, wow.
And
You've been there a long time, you mean, to see the changes?
yeah, I've been there for almost 20 years. And when
Oh,
I first
wow.
started there, everyone was like happy and pleasant with each other. And then there was like campus politics just started going
Oh,
downhill. And
I believe I may have read about that place.
well, I don't know. It's I think this is common in a lot of academia now,
No,
unfortunately.
there was just one in a couple of outspoken professors got really hammered. And you're right. It does happen in a lot of places and not just in academia. And you can feel it, and it's sort of a matter of trust, coming to learn to trust your gut feeling, as they say. And what to do about it. And sometimes you can change the situation and sometimes you can't, and you just have to leave for your own well-being.
Yeah, and I'm just teaching online, but even then I still feel it. But yeah, I think it's interesting to be able to feel the energies, and I think that most people can, even if they don't recognize it. And I felt that your work was really important in terms of being able to show, it was like, look, here's a lot of evidence for these things, and here's how it plays out. But we're still at the beginning, I think, that, once we get the acknowledgement or once these things are acknowledged, then we take the next step and figure out, you know, okay, what do we do with these? What's the extent? You know, so we're still
No, I think
being.
you're right. I think it's really, we're at a really interesting time that there's enough awareness of it that it can't be suppressed anymore and there's no going back.
Well, Rick, I know that I've kept you over the hour, so let you go. But thank you so much for your time. I really did enjoy the book. And could you give me your website one more time?
Sure. It's basically the title of the book .com.
Okay.
So it's
Okay.
www, the mystery of life energy.com.
Okay,
And
perfect.
you know, there's a lot of resources embedded on the site, like a video of that demonstration I talked about, some really nice images. And there's also a way for viewers to sign up for blog posts and updates and you know, some recent ones about the eclipse and some of the other stuff as well. So and you know, thank you again for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation and you have a great forum here and I appreciate what you're doing with it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I'll be sure to put the link for your website and the book in the show notes in the video description so that people can access them quite easily. So, and that's a wrap on episode 140 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family, coworkers, and on social media too, please. And, you know, like and subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing, all of that is really important. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of trying to improve the podcast and make more content for the YouTube channel. Your support will help me speed up this process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and create more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology. Psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So, if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel spirit.